Hi, everyone. It's me, Dahlia, and I am not here today with a new episode of Amicus. We are off this week, but I am here with something nice. This week, I joined What Next, Slate's new fantastic daily podcast, to talk about, among other things, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and whether you should freak out about her absence from oral arguments this past week. What Next is one of my favorite new shows of this year, and I will be a frequent commentator on the program if they'll have me. It's hosted by longtime journalist and podcaster Mary Harris. What Next will be coming to you each and every weekday with smart critical analysis from inside Slate's newsroom. Every episode of the show tackles some of the biggest issues and questions facing American politics and culture and society, and there is really nobody better to do this than Mary. If you like what you hear, I do encourage you to subscribe to this podcast in its own feed. It's the very best way to support the show and also to support all the journalism that we do here at Slate. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy.
Are you cold? Get out of here.
President Trump seemed to be losing patience with a press conference about 1 week ago today.
No, I'm just saying, should we keep this going a little
Please?
Bit longer?
Yes, indeed.
Go ahead. Let me know when you get tired.
And that's when he revealed this one last trick he has up his sleeve when it comes to the border wall he wants to build.
Have you considered using emergency powers to grant yourself authorities to build this wall without congressional approval? And second,
yes,
on Mexico, you have?
Yes, I have. And I can do it if I want.
Even the reporter who asked this question seemed a little surprised by the answer.
So is that a threat hanging over the Democrats?
I never threaten anybody. But I am allowed to do that, yes.
Each day since, there has been this debate. Can President Trump actually do this? It's a debate that sometimes the president seems to be having with himself. First, he said he may declare an emergency.
I may declare a national emergency.
A few days later,
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency.
And yesterday, just before he visited the border,
if this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
So which is it?
The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will. I have no doubt about it. I will.
When I heard Trump talking about his lawyers, I realized I wanted to call up a lawyer of my own. Luckily, Slate's got one, Dahlia Lithwick, and she's here to puzzle out this idea. Can Trump build a wall by fiat? And what will happen if he tries? Stay with us. This episode is brought to you by Kohler Connect. You've got a smartphone, a smart watch. What about a smart bathroom? Kohler's bringing the modern world into your bathroom. That means voice-controlled showers, touchless toilets, and connected lighted mirrors that enable you to personalize your routine like never before. Let Kohler Connect help you create a bathroom routine as unique as you are. Visit Kohler.com/smarthome to get started. That's Kohler.com, Kohler.com/smarthome. Dahlia Lithwick covers the courts and law for Slate. She's been living in suspense for a few days now about the president's looming threat of a national emergency.
Tuesday was going to be the big reveal, right? He was going to go on TV and declare a national state of emergency, and he had sort of been teeing that up, and that's what we thought would happen, and that didn't happen.
Dahlia doesn't really do suspense. She's a lawyer. Lawyers investigate and debate outcomes. They cite things. But the law doesn't really give a clear picture of what's going to happen in the case of a national emergency, at least not the kind President Trump is reportedly preparing to declare. The safe bet is that a declaration would invite a legal challenge. But what next?
People like his very own White House counsel were a little hinky about whether he has the constitutional authority to do what he wants to do. And interestingly, when he started making noises about I'm going to declare a state of emergency, I'm going to use eminent domain and seize all this, you know, non-government, non-military land. I'm going to, like, you know, including bird sanctuaries and, you know, Native American tribal lands. I'm going to just do it. And a lot of the pushback actually came from conservative commentators. So, you know, weirdly, you had like Ben Shapiro and David French and, you know, a lot of Andrew Napolitano on Fox News, which is who is, I think, Trump's real lawyer. All of them saying either I think this is unconstitutional flat out, or saying we squawked when Obama did this, right? When he started doing things by executive fiat. And moreover, we're going to flip out when, you know, President Cory Booker does it. So don't do it. And so I think in a weird way, he's been pinched, not just sort of between Rush Limbaugh, you know, and Ann Coulter, who are saying do it. And, you know, a lot of thoughtful conservative lawyers who are otherwise on his side about everything, who are saying either this is just flat out unconstitutional or this is a horrible precedent. So I think that this is not an easy move for him. And that's why he's been doing this. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Here I go. I'm going to. Oh, I didn't do it. But, you know, there's it's not an emergency. It's a crisis. But I think he's inching his way to it through a thicket of very serious legal guidance telling him this is a mistake.
Can you just remind us what a national emergency would actually allow him to do?
First of all, it's important to say there's no formal legal meaning for an emergency declaration. We don't know what that means exactly. We do know that the president has the power to issue an emergency declaration, and we actually know that the case that we think about when we think about this is the Steele seizures case from 1952, right? And
what happened there?
That was the case that went. So when, like, for instance, Mary, when Adam Schiff just says it's just flat out unconstitutional, he's citing Youngstown Sheet and Tube, which was this 1952 case. This is when President Truman tries to seize the steel mills during the Korean War. There's a labor dispute, and he says, I'm going to keep them open because we need this for war powers. And in a hugely powerful rebuke, the U.S. Supreme Court says, no, we are not going to accept your rationale for this kind of unilateral action. And then there becomes an incredibly important test for when the president has that authority. But all that happens before 1976, when Congress passes the National Emergencies Act. And that was supposed to be a post-Watergate corrective that was going to give the president authority to declare emergencies, but he also had to kind of check in with Congress and get Congress. He had to explicitly say what the emergency was, say what he was going to do, and then get repeated permission from the Congress. So this was meant to be a check. The effect was completely the opposite. It just institutionalized vast presidential authority. We've now got
because Congress just rubber stamps.
Congress doesn't even look at this. Congress,
there's like a guy in the basement who's just like, oh, I'm the national emergency guy.
In the 42 years since this has passed, only once has we seen Congress exercise any kind of authority over this. And literally, we're now in a situation where there. I just want to get the number because it's so funny. So CNN is reporting that there are actually 31 existing declared emergencies in the country that nobody is exercising oversight on. And we're all like, eh, okay, this would be the 32nd, which is just a sort of long way of saying that to the extent that we have this statute that's supposed to be giving Congress the power to check the president, they're all like on snooze.
I hear this and I think back to the opioid crisis where he was like, I'm going to declare a national emergency. And then it became a debate about what kind of emergency it was. And then it wasn't declared. And it seems like we haven't defined it well or put any checks and balances in.
Well, I think that that's the short answer to why on Tuesday what Trump declared was a crisis. And hilariously, it was largely a humanitarian crisis in this construction. So a crisis, I guess, is like the stop on the road before you get to an emergency. But I think he's trying to sell that there is this massive emergency going on. And I should just say, for purposes of what a court would have to do to determine, because presumably the minute this happens, somebody seeks an injunction, and this is tied up in litigation. One of the things the court's going to have to do is say, is this this a legit emergency? And what do you do with facts that, you know, illegal immigration is down, that drugs coming across the border at these, you know,
checkpoints,
at these checkpoints are not the way illegal drugs are being interdicted? So I think there is this whole over the question of, is this an emergency? And really, if it's an emergency and a plan is going to be like 10 years to build the wall, like, is this that kind of TikTok emergency?
And the DOJ could get in there too, right? Isn't their job to make sure that this is like right?
Yeah, well, the DOJ has been in the position of defending an awful lot of these kind of helter-skelter things that the president does. So the president, remember, immediately when he announced the travel ban, again, without really lawyering up what that meant, and Sally Yates, you know, being fired because she said, I can't enforce this. Donald Trump tends to do things like, I think I'm going to have like a ban on trans soldiers in the military, and then leave the DOJ to fix it. And in fact, one of the reasons he keeps losing in the courts is because, you know, including the family separation policy, including the sanctuary city policy, is because he doesn't have this legal architecture underneath it to support it. And the DOJ then is kind of rocked back on its heels. It has to defend something that is not always plausible. And there's this other super boring but super interesting kind of piece of this, which is that agencies have protocols that they have to follow when they effectuate these huge, huge changes. And one of the things he keeps doing is sort of saying, we don't even need to do any of that. And that actually ends up tangling him up in the courts.
Okay, one more thing. You cover the Supreme Court for Slate. And this week, something really surprising happened. Can you talk about it a little bit?
I can, with the huge caveat that I don't have insider information. Like, this is the thing, like, you know, my dad's calling me. My, like, what do you know? And I'm like, I don't have, like, a red bat phone to, like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So I can just tell you what I'm hearing, which is, yes, it's extraordinary. For the first time in over 25 years, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, by the way, like, has survived colon cancer and pancreatic cancer, is, you know, missing oral arguments this week.
And she didn't miss oral arguments after her husband died.
She was there. I was there the next day. She was on the bench reading, you know, a dissent. So she does not kid around. And she didn't miss when she was treated for other cancers. And so, you know, the world flipped out because she missed Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday arguments this week. So what I can tell you is what the surgeons are saying, which is, you know, she just had on December 25th, she had half of her left lung removed. This was the result of, you remember, they found some malignant nodes. They found the nodes because this is like
she
the house
fell.
That Jack fell because
yeah.
She cracked ribs. And only because they were X-raying the ribs did they find the nodes. So it's a huge surgery. Now she's home. She's working from home. She's listening to, you know, she's got the audio. She's reading transcripts. She's participating.
Yeah. What does working from home mean as a Supreme Court justice?
You know,
are her clerks there? Like, what's going on?
Then Chief Justice Rehnquist was very, very sick with thyroid cancer. And he just worked from his hospital bed, worked from home. So what she's doing is drafting opinions and reading draft opinions that other people have written and doing all the things that justices do, maybe to help put it in perspective. You know, they hear 12 cases a month for 6 days.
Mm.
So this is not a huge part of the job. It's the public facing part of the job. It's the part where we get to see them. And so I think we get this notion that this is the totality of what they do. But 95% of the job, it's like an iceberg, is the stuff that they would never put in like the TV show because it's so boring. It's just them reading and writing. And that's, she's perfectly capable of doing that from home. Now, that said, I guess we should add she's 85.
Yeah.
I think I read somewhere she's the fourth oldest, like, Supreme Court.
It's something like that. I mean, Kennedy retired at 90.
He was, Stevens. John Paul Stevens. Yeah,
Stevens
was older.
Retired at 90.
But, you know, Kennedy retired at 80.
Yeah.
So it's not 81, I think. It's not a trivial thing to be 85 and a three-time cancer survivor. And, you know, I think that we get very hagiographic about, like, her workout tapes. But she, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she's become this feminist icon. And I wonder if it just sort of prevents us from seeing the 85-year-old woman that she is in some ways. A friend of mine who's a lawyer posted, and I thought this was thoughtful. You know, there's this liberal debate of like, well, should she have retired while Obama was president? And she was like, you know, you got to be careful with that because part of feminism is letting people do what they want. And we've let these guys work until they're 90.
Well, that's what she said. One of the things she says is in response to that is like, weird. Nobody was demanding that John Paul Stevens retire. Nobody was demanding that Stephen Breyer retire. So I think she does see this valence of sexism around it, that, you know, there was this laser focus on why she wasn't stepping down. And I think that offends her. For what it's worth, anecdotally, a lot of people have said that she watched Sandra Day O'Connor get forced off the court. That's itself an amazing feminist story that doesn't get told, right? Where Chief Justice Rehnquist is incredibly sick. And O'Connor's husband is incredibly sick, so much so that she says, I'm going to have to next year, she says to the Chief Justice, I'm going to step down so that I can care for my husband. So stop and sit with the fact that, like, male justices don't retire to care for their ailing spouses. And then this is the kind of weird feminist bit. Chief Justice William Rehnquist says to her, actually, no, I'm going to retire next year. So you should go now. And he says to her, because you can't have two in the same summer. There's just a court tradition. Two confirmation hearings is too much of a jolt to the public system. So he says to her, essentially, don't do it next year. I'm going to do it next year. You do it now. She, by the way, I should just add, is at the height of her powers. At this moment, she's the most important woman in the country. She's the 5-4 vote, the swing vote. She was Kennedy before Kennedy was Kennedy. So he says, step down now. She steps down. And he promptly dies shortly after. So not only do we end up having two confirmation hearings, boom, boom, in a row, we have John Roberts and Alito, but then she ends up having stepped down before she was ready. And the real tragic coda, if you're counting sort of feminist indignities here, is that within a very, very short time, her husband is institutionalized. He doesn't recognize her anymore. Ginsburg has said she was forced off before she was ready, and she could have been on the court for 5 more years or 7 more years or whatever. And, you know, we don't know what the world would have looked like. And I think that story is playing in the back of Ginsburg's head when she's like, no man is going to tell me it's my time, because I saw that happen to a person who really, I think in many ways, was her sister at the Supreme Court. It's a long, long, long story.
No, I like that story. Yeah, I didn't know that story.
Yeah.
Dahlia Lithwick, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Mary, thank you as always for having me today.
Hello, everyone. It's me, the greatest president in the history of presidents. Those people at Trumpcast are at it again. They're not satisfied with just being a podcast and being highly rated. No, they're taking their show on the road. I'm advising you, do not go see Trumpcast live in, of all places, Los Angeles, a bastion of liberalism. Terrible, terrible state, California. And Los Angeles is the worst. Don't buy tickets at slate.com/live. Don't do it.
Before we go, one last rabbit hole I jumped down with Slate reporter Ruth Graham.
I think I heard about it the way everyone did, which is this strange, like, very positive, warm and fuzzy statement they posted on Twitter.
The it Ruth is talking about here, it's Jeff Bezos's divorce from his wife, Mackenzie. Their statement earlier this week ended like this. Though the labels might be different, we remain a family and we remain cherished friends.
It almost, I wrote, like, feels like an anniversary announcement, because it's all about, like, their shared life and their love and their continuing love and all of this. But it was a divorce announcement after 25 years of marriage.
I mean, it's like, I'm thinking of Gwyneth Paltrow. What did she call it when she announced her divorce?
Yeah, a conscious uncoupling. It felt very much like that.
Around the newsroom, this is a story we just can't stop talking about. Maybe it's because Bezos is the world's richest person. Maybe it's because Amazon is so deeply embedded in our lives. Maybe it's just because we love the crazy details about how Bezos and his wife met.
They've been married since before he started Amazon. And he's described it as sort of like that he approached this as like a professional dater back then, to when he was ready to find someone to get serious with, this really systematic approach. So And he called it the women flow, which is a play on this term deal flow, which I guess is a Wall Street term for kind of managing the offers that come your way. Like, you won't even waste your time on anything, you know, less than $5 million or whatever. It's a way of like filtering out the deals that you want to even consider.
The funny thing is like, I can't tell if it's like gross or endearing.
I mean, I think it's endearing when it's told as an endearing story. And then when you're looking back on it, like after something like this falls apart and after now, you know, the National Enquirer is reporting that he has moved on with this like glamazon wife of his best friend. And then that makes it a little like weird and gross and clinical to look back at his like selection of his perfect mate in his 20s, who he's now moved on from.
Maybe we can't stop talking about this story because in a way it's reassuring that there are no perfect mates, no matter who you are. And that's the show. Tell us what you think by leaving a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Your review is how people find us, and we want more people to find us, so help us out. You can find us on Twitter at Slate Podcasts, or you can find me at Mary's Desk. And if you're taking a break from Twitter, I respect that. But just keep listening. What Next is hosted by me, Mary Harris, and produced by Mary Wilson and Jason DeLeon, with loads of help from Danielle Hewitt. Talk to you tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, Slate's podcast on the courts and the law, inviting you to our live show in Washington, D.C. at 6 and I. It's going to be a packed evening with me, Mark Joseph Stern, and amazing special guests gathering on stage for the capstone conversation of How Originalism Ate the Law, our print and podcast series tackling the legal theory that stripped abortion access for millions, radically expanded gun rights, and gutted our voting rights. We are answering questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? And perhaps most crucially, what can we do about this? Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets and information on accessing the VIP happy hour. And Slate Plus members, part of our evening will be reserved exclusively for questions from you, our loyal subscribers. So even if you cannot join us in person in Washington, D.C. on May 14th, you can always send your questions to amicus@slate.com, and we will try to answer as many as we can.